couple of minutes late, but we hope that doesn't put us too far behind. We are going to take some bills not in the order they are today because we have Mr. Secretary of State here, and I don't want to keep him waiting. So we're going to take that bill first, and then we'll go into 1092, and then we will have the informational hearing on resource fees, probably around close to 5. So if you're here on that, you can play in the hall a little bit, but don't go too far. And before I get any further along, I do remind everyone to please turn off your cell phones or any automated device that makes noise, because if I hear it, and I have very good ears, you'll be making a contribution to the Common School Fund. So with that being said, Ms. Richardson, I'm going to open a public hearing on SJR 41. Why don't you tell us what it's about? And Senator George, you can come forward and speak to it. And then we'll hear from the Secretary of State.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SJR 41 establishes by constitutional amendment Joint Committee on Audits and Government Accountability within the legislature. It authorizes that committee to appoint a legislative auditor. It authorizes the auditor, at the direction of the committee, to conduct financial and compliance audits of at least 2 executive department agencies once every 2 years. It requires submission of the proposed amendment for approval or rejection at the next general election. The bill currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The bill currently has a blank on page 2, line 3. You have before you dash 1 amendments that fill in that blank and specify that one financial and compliance audit must be of an agency with a biennial budget of more than $1
billion. Okay. Senator George, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. I'm Larry George, State Senate, District 13. I appreciate the chair being willing to hear Senate Joint Resolution 41. It's an issue that I think is of a very large importance to all of us. The fact is that all of us, when we're out campaigning, talk about accountability in government. In addition, when we've come into this annual session or discussion about annual sessions, we talk about the importance of the legislative branch, about bringing the legislative branch to a level where we could be equal with other branches of government. And I think nothing's probably more important than our constitutional authority to give out money through the appropriations process. And currently, once we pass those dollars out, the executive branch is the ones that does the audits. So the Secretary of State's office does the audits of what the rest of the executive branch is doing. And I don't object to that. In fact, for the most part, I think the Secretary of State's office has done a fine job. But again, it is the executive branch doing the audits of the executive branch. What Senate Joint Resolution 41 does is also provides an opportunity for the legislative branch to have an audits function also. It doesn't take away the audit's responsibilities from the Secretary of State. It doesn't take away the internal audits of the executive branch, but as a separate branch of government who does give out the dollars, it gives us the opportunity to review agencies' budgets. One of the things that has really affected me on the need for the legislature to reassert itself into some of these issues is my own personal experience. Many of you know that I've been both a staffer and a lobbyist in this building long before I became a legislator. In 1991, the all funds budget that was concluding that year was about $15 billion. All funds, federal funds, everything was about $15 billion. This last budget that we did was over $48 billion, which means we've tripled in 17 years. And I've got a little bit of a budget history that we've looked at. And what we've seen is a significant growth in the last 17 years of not only the general fund, but lottery funds, other funds, and federal funds coming in, which means that when we're divvying up, we talk about the general fund budget. Really, we're only talking about 25% of the budget nowadays. No longer is the general fund the most significant source of revenue for agencies. It's all of these other funds that are coming in from different directions, whether it be the federal government, whether it be other funds, that fees that we've set up. And the question is whether or not we are going to assert ourselves into the idea of the policy making of those dollars that we're allowing state agencies to spend. We talk about, all of us talk about, of all parties, we talk about the idea of accountability in government. And I think it's important that the executive branch has that function at the Secretary of State's office. But I think it's even more important, as we talk about taking a more responsible role in how the state government spends its dollars, that we have the ability to have audits functions here at the legislature. so that we can delve into the budgets in the same kind of way, and that we can take a look at the overall policy of how the executive branch is spending those dollars. And I appreciate, again, Chair Walker, the opportunity to come and at least open up this conversation about what I think is an important role about the legislature reestablishing itself as the watchdog for the taxpayers' dollars.
Thank you, Senator George. I have a couple questions, and then I'll open it up to my committee. What struck me, and I highlighted it in my notes, is you said that this resolution would give us the opportunity to review agency budgets. Well, I sit on Ways and Means. Senator Morris has sat on Ways and Means, and we review budgets all the time. In fact, sort of ad nauseum, budget after budget after budget, chart after chart, and I'm not a chart person. I'm a visual person, but charts drive me crazy. But that's what we get. So I'm not sure what it is you want, because we're already reviewing those budgets.
Well, it's easy, I guess, to explain it this way, is that almost every company has a board of directors where you get the chart after chart after chart of what's happening in a company. Our accountants give to me, in our businesses that we own, give me an overview with a balance sheet statement that says, here's the assets and here are the liabilities, here's your profit loss statement. And that's what we're reviewing as in Ways and Means. You see top-line-based numbers. Every few years, we hire an outside audit firm to go through and evaluate how we're spending our dollars in our corporation, which means they do a thorough review of all the expenditures we make. Mm-hmm. We're then submitting that to the IRS. And sometimes the IRS comes into companies and then does a separate audit to make sure that the books are actually accurate. And the idea behind it is that we as and our normal Ways and Means function can be looked at as a board of directors. The agencies come forward and give us a series of numbers that you can say is ad nauseum. But the question is that what do we know beyond that baseline number that you saw on that chart? Are we actually having auditors go in and see, are they actually following through with the policy? We appropriated dollars for this line. They're saying they're spending on that. Are they actually doing it? Do we have staff that have the ability to walk into an agency and say, are we actually spending those dollars for those kinds, for that exact appropriations? And what I'd say is if you look at it, what the Secretary of State's office does is a very thorough process of doing that. But again, that's the executive branch on the executive branch. What we need to do is have that same kind of thorough review by our staff in our realm as the legislative branch of government to have that same check on the state agencies.
Hmm. Well, I'll be interested in hearing. I hope Mr. Hibner signed up to testify. It's no secret, I've had a strong interest in what the Secretary of State's office does lately. But and I've spoken at length with Mr. Hibner about the audits function because I actually love that piece of what the Secretary of State is responsible for doing, and they do audit state agencies now. So I'm still kind of unclear. And also, we have a legislative audit committee. It's not, I don't think it's a statutory committee, but it's we have an audit committee. So it is statutory, that's right. So there's not one in the special session. So I'm still a little unclear with the audit committee and with the functions that we do in Ways and Means. I guess I'm still not clear what you think we could do better by doing it this way.
Chair Walker, thank you. I think that exactly what you said a few minutes ago is you said that when you review what the Secretary of State is doing, it's a very important function, and it's a function that you admire what they're doing. And all I'm saying is that what the Secretary of State does in the audits function is an important part of function of state government. But that's done in the executive branch. The executive branch is doing an internal audit on the executive branch. We, as the legislative branch, separate branch of government, need to have that audit authority in our branch of government so that we can be confident before we even dish out those dollars on the front end that we're confident on how those dollars are being spent. And I guess what I'd say is that for everything you see as the benefit of the Secretary of State's office, I would agree with you. But I also think that there's no doubt in anybody's mind that the legislative branch over the last, I would say especially 25 years, has seen its role in state government be diminished for a variety of reasons.
And one of those,
absolutely, absolutely. But I don't think, I think that one of the things we need to start with is the idea that we are not simply a branch of government that comes together and somebody can come in, give us a quick slide presentation, and we divvy out, you know, if you'll look at the numbers based on this was produced for Senator Cruz's amendment to the bill. If you'll look at some of these agencies, like the Human Services Department, $11.5 billion. And that's a lot of dollars, and it would be nice for us to have an audits committee that can report back and really delve into that budget for legislators who have an interest and who want to take a more close look at this. That's separate and independent from what the executive branch is doing through the Secretary of State.
Okay. Now, you mentioned an amendment. Is that your amendment, or is that Senator Cruz's amendment? Okay. Then I'm going to open it up for questions from the committee. Well, let's have Senator Cruz go first, since he's got an amendment, and then I'll take you, Senator Morris, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My amendment is the dash ones, which you should have, that basically delete line 17 of the bill and insert a total biennial budget of more than $1 billion for audit during each two-year period. It was to fill in the blank, and the decision was, originally we were looking at how many employees the agency had as to be the tipping point, and we decided the dollar number in their budget would be a better tipping point. And you should also have received a sheet that lists the eight agencies in the state that have a budget of over $1 billion plus PERS, which is way over $1 billion. But I think one thing that I would point out as part of the inequity, if you look clear down at the bottom, you see Department of Administrative Services that has a budget of over $1 billion. That is the governor's staff. It's over $1 billion. And you know, you say that we do all these things in Ways and Means, and we do, but clearly we do not have the resources allocated to the legislative branch of government and legislative fiscal or legislative revenue to really be able to do anything independent. What we end up with in Ways and Means, just because of the sheer volume of the work, is relying heavily on DAS and BAM, Department of Administrative Services and Budget and Management, excuse me for the acronyms, to inform us as we're going through budgets. And especially, you know, we purposely stuck with large agencies because we don't want to necessarily overburden this office as well. But, you know, I think it is time. You know, we have, I think it was 6 years ago, we gave DAS an additional, 6 or 8 years ago, gave DAS an additional 100 FTE. For reasons that still aren't clear to me. And yet at the same time, we refuse to give the Legislative Assembly the resources necessary to do its own work. And this is an attempt to move us in that direction. This isn't a panacea. I would like to see us triple the staff in LFO, get us on a level of what the state of Washington does, so we can do our own work instead of relying on the executive branch. And this is no knock against the executive branch. It's certainly no knock against the work that Secretary of State's office does. But clearly, if we are an equal branch of government, we need to start treating ourselves as we are. And over the years, we've done this to ourselves. We clearly have, and it's time to reverse the trend. And I think this is a good start. Plus, I think the fact you send something like this out to the people, because people are screaming for accountability in government. And this would be a clear sign to the people of Oregon that we're serious about trying to get to accountability.
All right. Is there a question there?
No. I was explaining the amendment.
Well, I appreciate that explanation. I really do. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue of equal branches of government between the executive branch and legislative branch is a very real issue. And this is not a partisan issue. It's something that I've sensed has been discussed within this building for quite some time. And in fact, this issue was one of the major focuses of the Public Commission on the Legislature in the 05-06 interim. And the need does exist for this body to have a closer nexus to understanding, really understanding what's going on inside these agencies and the budgeting process. So the need for this, I think, is real. A concern that I would have is the language of the bill, a financial and compliance audit. It's entirely possible to have an agency that meets all the standards of accounting principles and in compliance with statutes and can still be a wasteful, mm-hmm. inefficient agency. So I think, you know, the discussion, I think, would be better focused with respect to performance auditing rather than accounting standards and statute compliance.
Well, and Senator Morse, didn't we just pass your bill out of committee yesterday that sort of addresses these issues?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That bill focused in a different direction.
Well,
it was not one of compliance. It was one of collaboration.
All right. Do I have any questions here? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator George, a couple of things. First of all, would you explain to me why we would need a constitutional amendment, first of all? I mean, since the legislature does appropriate and we have fiscal oversight that we can do and we can allocate as many dollars as we want to that, if you'd explain to me why this would have to be constitutional in order for the legislature to do more in-depth financial review.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, I think that I'm not sure exactly why we need to have a constitutional amendment, but as I understand it, so I'm telling you how as I understand it, I may be incorrect, but as I understand it, once we pass out those dollars, once we release those dollars from when we pass the bill, those dollars then become in the hands of the executive branch. And there's many times where you get a separation of powers issue if we try to mess with those dollars once those dollars are out the door. Now, we can always demand accountability once we come back into the next session with the new legislature and we start to talk about the new budget for the next biennium. But as I understand the need is that there needs to be a clear distinction that the legislative branch has the power to do ongoing audits of what the executive branch does. I dealt with this when in during the 1990s when I was trying to deal with administrative rules reform. The Oregon Supreme Court has ruled several different times on the separation of powers issues, and they have really taken a strong role that once the once we as the legislature grant power to the executive branch, that it's very difficult for us to pull that power back. And the separation of powers issues is something that the Supreme Court has taken a look at very, very carefully. Now, it could be that we could bolster up our own LFO and that we could do many of these functions with that, and it may be totally constitutional. But I think my fear has been is that once we do that, if we try to enforce the fact that we pass this X amount of dollars for this specific purpose, and that once we've let the horse out of the barn, that we say, hey, you're not spending those dollars for what we told you to, there could be a separation of powers issue. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why that I asked for it to be a constitutional amendment, just to make sure that there's absolutely no question about our ability to look over the executive branch's shoulders based on decisions that the Supreme Court has made over the last 20 years or so on the separation of powers in the state of Oregon. And so I'm not sure it has to be done this way, but I also think it's important as we go through this discussion of annual sessions and bringing back power to the legislative branch that we also vest the public in the idea that the legislative branch is the branch as the watchdog of the taxpayers' dollars. We're 90 people who have been elected directly by the citizens of the state to represent the people. So I also believe that it's important to vest the public in the idea that the legislative branch is where they can go to demand accountability of the executive branch as the executive branch is implementing state policies. So I'm not sure it's absolutely necessary, but I think it's a safeguard, and I think it vests the public in the process.
Next point, you mentioned that the current audits division that we have that's under the direction of the Secretary of State, and we'll hear from that office here shortly, has done a good job. I know they have been responsive in the past. I asked that a review be done, an audit of the Veterans Affairs Department as a result of constituent issues. That was done, and it was illustrative to some of the issues, of which then as legislators, you know, part of it is our ability and willingness to access and then do a peer review, I guess you might say, of what those findings are and take whatever action on it. But certainly the information that I have found in those cases has been there. And so, again, as Senator Walker mentioned, I would still just have some concern as how much of it is the fact that the work may not be viewed by some to be independent, or is it the fact that we as legislators need to exercise our review and action as a result of some of those? I mean, so that would be one question I would have. And the other would point to what Senator Morris pointed out, certainly in just in the language about financial and compliance audit. And I know, you know, being as a director of a credit union and going through the audit process and, you know, basically financial and auditing basically is your general accounting practices, and they can tell you they spend money exactly the way they said they would, but that doesn't mean they were spending it on things you think they want to be spending it on. And so part of it may be, I think, whether it's our current system or a system as you proposed, Senators, is looking at through our fiscal, legislative fiscal, when we talk about strengthening the legislative branch, is holding agencies more accountable to what you had mentioned, Senator Morris. If we put accountability measures in terms of performance for the expenditures, and you know, add more of those type of benchmarks to the fiscal allocations that we do in the legislative session, as well as financial accountability, but performance accountability, meeting other state benchmarks as a way of controlling how well that spending. And I think that's another way to strengthen the legislative branch. That would be my observation.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, answer your first question. Your second question first is I agree with you. I think what Senator Morris's comments were exactly on point, and was more of an oversight on my part. I do believe that that's what we really need an audit's function for, is that we need to make sure that they're actually performing, and not just that they're following accounting principles. I absolutely agree, and would hope that the committee, if they went into work session with this bill, would make that amendment and would look at it as very friendly and actually follows the intent of what we were trying to do when we drafted this. To answer your second point, and I think Senator Walker brought up a really good point about this, you know, you have the Secretary of State already doing this, reduplicating services, and it really is, is the strong belief that whatever we think of the Secretary of State's job so far, many of us have had good a good view of how the Secretary of State has done their audits. It is the difference between an internal audit and an external audit, meaning when the Secretary of State is doing an audit, they are part of the executive branch. And what we're talking about here is giving the legislative branch the ability to take a look at the budget in action and take a look at it as an independent view of what the executive branch is implementing of our policies. And so I really think that I don't really want to get into whether or not the Secretary of State, you know, they're doing a great job or a bad job. It's not even really, I don't really have a concern. I'm really looking at the role of the legislature and saying, are we taking ourselves seriously? You all know that I've complained, Senator Metzger knows this especially, I've complained a lot about the fact that we say let agencies set fees by rules, and how often we have state policy that says go ahead and take care of this policy by rule. And what we're doing is every time we do that as a body, we are granting some of our power from the legislative branch to the executive branch. And it's been of concern to me since I've been down here in the late 80s as a staffer, and I've watched sort of the tone difference. I don't know if it was the term limits or what it was, but the reliance on the executive branch to do our work. And at some point, we need to reassert ourselves and say it is important that we have a role in this as an independent branch of state government. And that's what I'm. At least this discussion needs to happen. So I appreciate it.
Are you okay, Senator Hass?
Thank you. I just want to emphasize Senator Metzger's point. When I was first here in 8 years ago, there was a Secretary of State's performance audit on the Oregon lottery that was very critical. Financially, everything was in compliance in terms of the amount of money in was the same as money out, and the books were kept well. I remember that specifically. But what they spent the money on, trips and bonuses and all of that stuff, was terrible. And because of that, the legislature took that performance audit and the findings and essentially restructured the entire agency. People were fired and made the appropriate changes. And so I frankly think that's what you're going for, and the intent is the same here, but that was done. It wasn't in the Constitution, and it was a performance audit, not a financial compliance audit. And financially, I wish we could do more of those. Not that they're always critical, but I think that part of it is if agencies always know that they're going to be subjected to that, maybe that keeps them a little more honest. But I don't understand, too, the need to put this in the Constitution, or why you would not do performance audits if we want to go that direction.
Chair Walker, Senator Haas, I think that what I would like to do, if you guys go into work session on this, is make sure the performance audits are part of the whole discussion of what Senator Metzger and Senator Morris have talked about. I think that's an important part of it. But I really think that if you look at what the Supreme Court has ruled on issues like administrative rules, I think you really need to look at the importance of the legislature having the specific authority to go forward and specific authority to do this. And we can do a review of their books, but I'm just saying that what we have seen from the Supreme Court is that they really have defended the independence of the executive branch. And they've defended them, and whether you believe it's appropriate or inappropriate, I think they've done it to the detriment of the legislative branch. And so that's one of the reasons why I would say at least we should consider putting this in the Constitution. We could try to do it statutorily first and see where we ended up, but I think that with a referral to the people, that you also vest the public in the knowledge that we are the watchdogs of the taxpayer dollar.
Okay, thank you, Senator George. Did you have a
thank
conversation
you.
With the Secretary of State's Office of the Audits Division before you dropped your bill?
You know, I had a brief conversation yesterday when I saw it was scheduled of what it was about. I did not talk to the Secretary of State at all. I just talked to one of their staff members and made sure that they knew that I wasn't trying to take any power away from the Secretary of State's
okay.
office. That wasn't my intent.
I hope that you or a staff person can listen in to their testimony and
okay.
see how they feel about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we will take Mr. Secretary himself, Bill Bradbury, and Mr. Secretary, do you want to bring up Mr. Hibner at the same time?
Mr. Hibner, join me if that's okay with you.
I would be delighted. Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State, a real pleasure to be here. I'm going to say something at the beginning that is sort of what we were just talking about. I really appreciate the concern that Senator George has brought forward. I remember it from when I served in the legislature. It's a concern about, yes, we all sit in Ways and Means and appropriate money, but there's a concern about seeing the performance of that money and tracking it more closely. I would just propose that the bill should not talk about audits. The bill should talk about budget reviews. And so I'll get more into that after I give you a little overview on something I'm very proud of, which is I've served as Secretary of State for 9 years now, and I'm very proud of the work that the Audits Division has done. And I think all of you know that the Secretary of State in the Constitution is the auditor of public accounts, and that charges us with making sure that government is spending its money appropriately. And over the years, obviously, not just my 9-year tenure, but over the years, we've developed a pretty experienced team. That team currently consists of 68 professional trained auditors, most of whom are CPAs or MPAs, and all are generally considered experts in their field that they work on. Now, currently we average issuing about 40 reports each year, and this is in addition to our single largest audit, which looks at the state's financial statements and it basically completes the requirements for a federal single audit, which is a huge amount of work and takes about a third of our available audit hours just to get that, just to make sure we can continue to get $6 or $8 billion from the federal government. The agency makes about 125 recommendations per year in terms of audit recommendations that come out. And we're consistently asked by legislators, and we're asked by state agencies to look at issues for them. So it's really providing some service to folks here. Not surprisingly, since 1997, the State Audits Division has identified savings of nearly $200 million. The agency manages the state's government waste hotline that I think you're all very familiar with, where someone can call and say, there's something being wasted here.
We fixed that bill a little bit last session with an anonymous report.
Right. And that waste hotline has delivered $6.4 million in savings and question costs since 1995. And if you average the savings since the 1990s, the State Audits Division has delivered a 20-to-1 return on state investment. In other words, for every dollar put into the agency, we have identified $20 in savings, or $25 in savings and potential savings. The agency's external peer reviews, which goes on in the audit world, they have all these people that come in from all these other states and look at the work that Chuck is doing. The National State Auditors Association report that they make, they came in 2007 and really spoke highly of our policies and practices. And those reports have regularly come back free and clear in terms of running an appropriate audit shop. We've become a very trusted source of information, and our mission is to be independent, reliable, and useful. So I would only speak to caution the committee as you move forward on this proposed legislation. The benefit of the Secretary of State being the auditor is a significant hallowed trademark of an auditor, and that benefit is independence. The Secretary of State does not create revenue, I can assure you of that, nor does it appropriate monies, and all of those activities can prejudice an audit. The Secretary of State is independent. We're considered part of the executive branch, but I am an independently elected officer from the governor. I am not responsible to the governor. I am an independent officer. And the framers of the Oregon Constitution were wise to recognize that the Secretary of State's office was the only office with the necessary independence needed to produce impartial audits. So I'm very proud of this operation. I just want to, I said at the beginning, I think there's, and we've been around on this issue three or four sessions now, and I think, as a former legislator, I think there is an incredible desire that I hear people expressing here on the part of the legislature to have adequate staff resources to follow the money. And that doesn't conflict. I want to be real clear here. That does not conflict with auditing. It's a very different function than auditing. And that's why I said to you, just take the word audit out of this proposal and talk about legislative budgetary performance review. Well, I mean, I'm just making it up, but put it something like that in, and you don't get into a conflict with the Constitution. You don't need to amend the Constitution, because clearly the legislature has complete authority to review what folks are doing with the money you've appropriated. So, as a former legislator, I really felt the need, when I was the co-chair of Ways and Means, to have some follow-on. I just want to say the follow-on in terms of following money is really different than auditing. It's different. And it's really specifically wanting to know, okay, we've appropriated this money. We want to see how it's being spent. We want to see those kind of things. And we have these benchmarks and performance things, and we want to see what's happening. That's the legislature is involved in policy. That's great. And I really believe that it makes sense for you to have the staff to follow your policy and follow your money. That makes a whole lot of sense. It's a very different function from the audit function specifically that the Constitution calls for.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Sorry it took so long, Madam Chair.
No, it was very enlightening, and I liked your excitement about it. After 9 years, you're still very excited. Good. Any questions? Okay, let's hear from Mr. Hibner.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division. I really am here to answer questions. I provided some written testimony. I think the discussion prior to this clarified for me a lot of things. I wasn't quite sure why there would be the need for a second opinion audit of any given set of financial statements if it's done by a qualified CPA. Some of our larger ones are even done by big firms like Moss Adams or Deloitte & Touche or others. We hire them to do the work for us. So it's I wasn't quite sure what was missing that would require a second opinion on a set of financial statements. So the duplicate financial audit was a little bit confusing to me.
Okay. Well, I think that prompted a question from Senator Metz.
Yeah. Mr. Hibner, I would be curious to relate back to what Senator George said about the executive branch, overseeing the executive branch in terms of auditing and the separation issues, why we would need that. And certainly on its face, I think everybody's skeptical of government, although I would say legislative audits, knowing the legislative polling, they might be less believable of our audits than maybe even your own audits. But be that as it may, how long have you been in your position?
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, since the end of 2005.
Okay.
The director. I've been with the division since 1995.
Okay, since 95. So you've been almost 13 years. How many times can you tell us that the Secretary of State or any other executive branch member has attempted to influence the results of your audits in your department?
Successfully influenced? Because, the influence, the discussions.
Well, why don't we start with the first
question?
Why don't we say it the first time? I mean, how often have someone attempted to influence your decisions? And then you can tell me how many times that has been successful in your view.
You can probably imagine that those sorts of discussions happen fairly regularly. But successfully influenced, get us to go to a position that we wouldn't go to, it would never happen. Our professional reputation, integrity is everything for an auditor. People need to believe what it is we put out there. When we sign our name on that line, it means something. Integrity, independence, it's all wrapped into one, so never.
Well, I believe that. So, but now you actually raised another question with me. So there has been attempts to influence. I would be curious, have any of those attempts been by members of the Legislative Assembly as opposed to the Executive Branch?
I'm not recalling any instances of that, no.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you. That was kind of funny there. But you, only in the sense that the legislature can ask you to perform an audit. I recently sent you an email from a constituent who has concerns about the Commission for the Blind, and lo and behold, you happen to be doing an audit with them, and so you are able to talk to the constituent, find out their concerns, and add that to the audit. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that's not influencing the audit. That's simply telling you here's some issues that you might want to look at, and then you do with them what you would normally do as trained CPAs, correct?
Chair Walker, that's correct. We stand independent. I mean, but we are always looking for providing relevant and timely information. That's what we do. We're an information provider. So we want to know what people want to hear about. And we're twice a year we go out and try to get ideas from legislators, from DAS, from others as to what sorts of issues are the issues of the moment and would like some audit attention. So we're always open to suggestions. We may not be able to handle them all, either due to staffing or maybe they're not audit issues. But we'll certainly take them all seriously and consider those and do what we can to provide the information that people need.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, since you are independent and your boss is sitting right next to you, what do you think of the secretary's idea that this should be more described as performance review?
Chair Walker, there was Senator Morris may be able to help me out a little here too. He was a part of the commission, the redesigning. I'm going to get the title wrong and probably really put myself in a corner. But part one of the initiatives that came out of that was trying to address the concerns that the legislature has about getting oversight, making sure that what they're hearing from agencies is accurate. And what we kind of settled on was something of a program evaluation nature. There is a science out there. It's called program evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
Our former director, John Latimer, was very familiar with that, and he was a part of this commission as well. And during discussions, it seemed like that may be the approach that would make the most sense for the legislature. It wouldn't be an audit. It has a set of rules and criteria that can be applied to kind of provide the professionalism around the analysis. It's scientific method, just like what we do, but maybe it's a little bit lighter, maybe a little skinnier. Certainly not as expensive. Doing audits mm-hmm. costs a lot. So depending upon how quickly you need the information, how deep you need to go, it seemed like the program evaluation option was something that should have been considered. And it was. It made it into a bill. Didn't get much in the way of legs. I testified, I think. I was certainly there when Mr. Latimer was there and testified about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what Mr. Secretary is talking about, and I think what Senator Morris would have been a proponent of at that time, too, would have been the whole program evaluation sort of thing that is just an easier thing to manage from a resource point of view and may provide you the quicker turnaround on information mm-hmm. that you really are looking for.
I don't remember. We must not have gotten that bill in our
committee. I think it was a House bill.
Yeah, because I don't have a recollection at all about this discussion. I'd like to review that. I'll pull up the testimony.
I can look through my paperwork as well. I'm sure I've got a copy of it.
Yeah, I would appreciate that because I did
give you the number.
I did find out that the minutes of these kinds of hearings right now are pretty blank.
Hmm.
They've gone from offering you word for word what you can find people said to basically getting nothing, and so I've actually put a complaint in about that, and that's something that we're working on changing. I mean, the other day I did a Google search of someone who had been appointed by the governor to serve on the Transportation Commission. I wanted to find out more about this individual. Well, he testified years ago as an agency person, and it showed up on the web. There was Google, and there was the whole list of what was going on and everybody, what they were saying, and today you call it up and you get nothing. So you just sit there and transcribe it. Now, I'm a court reporter, but not everybody else is. So if you have information on that, I'd appreciate it. Senator Morris, did you want to respond to that comment? Isn't that something that came out of the public commission?
Well, I would lobby for that bill. I'd love to see that bill come back, but of course we're facing something on Friday that I think none of us are going to look forward to, and that is limited resources mm-hmm. forecast for the future. So it may not be the time to add expense to the legislative body, but Mr. Hibner is absolutely correct. It's the programmatic review, and we did have extensive discussion in our subcommittee about and learning the technical aspects of what a financial audit is, a performance audit, and a programmatic review. And what this bill really is addressing is a programmatic review.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, any other questions?
Just a clarification as to why this was a constitutional amendment, because the Constitution does give Secretary of State the only authority to do audits. And so if it was going to be performance or whatever it was, if it is an audit and we're going to do it, it would have to be a constitutional amendment because the sole authority rests with Secretary of State in the Constitution.
Yes, the Secretary of State is, Madam Chair, the Secretary of State is the auditor of public accounts in the Constitution. And that's why I said right at the beginning, if you get rid of the word audit in here and we talk about program review, I don't think we have any, there's mm-hmm. no problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even need to amend the Constitution.
Mm. Well, and that's your last point's very well taken. We don't need to amend the Constitution if we do that, which makes this bill not workable because it is a referral. But this has been an enlightening conversation. Does anyone have any other questions? I appreciate it because I'm not going to move this bill based on the testimony I've heard today. I think in 2009 I'd like to see us take a look at that bill. The House didn't move. And I would appreciate it, Mr. Hibner, if you could get me the information that you used in the testimony. And thank you for taking time out of your day.
Thank you.
We will close the hearing on SJR 41. And I think I indicated we would move to 1092.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1092. Ms. Richardson, you can tell us about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1092 requires a person filing a petition for jurisdiction in juvenile court to notify a youth school or school district superintendent within 15 days from the petition filing. Requires the principal to notify school employees and school subcontractors who may be in direct contact with the youth in order to arrange appropriate counseling and education and protect school employees, subcontractors, and students. Requires person filing petition to notify youth school or school district superintendent if the petition is set aside, dismissed, or outside of the court's jurisdiction. Requires the principal to notify school employees and subcontractors if the petition is set aside, dismissed, or outside the court's jurisdiction. Requires the principal to retain documentation of notice separate from the youth's educational record and provide to subsequent school if youth transfers. It prescribes use of such information for admissions or disciplinary decisions unless a violation occurred during school function, on school property, or within 1,500 feet of the school property. It mandates standards for maintenance and destruction of juvenile court information that is held by the school. It requires expungement of documentation under certain circumstances. It requires the principal to contact school of out-of-state transfer youth and request information regarding youth's history of activities likely to risk safety of school employees, school subcontractors, or students that require arrangements for counseling or education. It requires the principal to notify school employees or school subcontractors who may be in direct contact with the youth if such information is received. It provides that all such information is confidential. It provides exceptions. It decreases time for notice of the youth being charged as adult from 15 days to 5 days. There are -1 and -2 amendments before you. I apologize. They are not summarized on your staff measure summaries, primarily because your committee administrator has not read them because we received them just as our hearing began today. But you will be focusing, as I'm sure will become clear through testimony, on the -2 amendments.
All right. Great. Thank you, Ms. Richardson. And this is Senator Hass's bill, so I'm going to let him talk about it from here, and then we will go into the testimony, and there's quite a bit of testimony, so we hope to keep it moving along. Senator Hass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, there has been a lot of work in the last 48 hours to accommodate different parties, and so I would ask that you look at the -2s to 1092, which I think cleaned up a lot of the language, narrowed down some definitions, and replaced everything, including changes in the -1. So we're looking, and we're looking at the -2 amendments. The problem here that this is trying to solve is that when school starts every year, teachers and staff know the backgrounds of most of the kids in these classrooms, whether it's their academics, transcripts, straight A's, special needs, health problems, and often criminal backgrounds. But they sometimes don't know the criminal or sometimes violent backgrounds of new students who have transferred in, and this is what this bill tries to fix. The impetus for this bill is that in some states, most notably California, there are agreements similar to plea agreements with juvenile offenders and their parents that often goes like this. We'll give you a lesser punishment or in some cases no punishment or conviction at all if you agree to stay out of the California school system forever. And so what happens in those situations, which is usually a very good deal for the offender, is they move to live with grandpa in Medford. or Aunt Vicky in Eugene. And this bill doesn't prevent these kids from being admitted or in any way disciplines them or punishes them. It just provides this relevant information to some of the teachers or the relevant school staff. These are crimes that have been, as I mentioned, culled, and they are a very narrow and very serious list. If you look at the dash twos, homicide, assault, sex crimes, drugs, it's been narrowed considerably to reach a compromise with those who I think in the first version raised their eyebrows. So I do think there's a solid meeting of the minds here. And we'll hear some stories today, I think, from some witnesses and some people who work in the schools that illustrate why this is an important safety bill and helps real people in our schools. And we also have standing by some experts with some technical help. And I wanted to make sure you knew one last thing, that there is no liability being conferred upon school districts. It just allows them to err on the side of sharing background information with a limited group of school employees that work with students who may have a violent or criminal past. And in addition, the lawyers who previewed this bill ensures it in no way violates federal privacy laws. So similar measures have been adopted in 12 other states. I see it as a very simple safety bill that creates a more safe atmosphere in Oregon schools.
Thank you, Senator Haas. And we do have an opinion from Legislative Council that the bill is constitutional as written, because there was some question about that. So if anyone wants to review that opinion, I have a copy of it here. Any questions of Senator Haas before I take witnesses? Okay. Then let's hear from some of the teachers. Alan Bruner and Ginger Redlinger, I believe. And Ms. Wimmer Whalen, are you coming up with them?
I'll stand by.
Okay, well, just come on up. There's three seats. Welcome. Take your pick. Who's going to start first?
Chair Walker, Senators Cruz, Haas, Metzger, and Morse. Thank you for considering this legislation. I'm a teacher at Oregon City High School with 17 years experience in education. It took me 16 years to figure out that the information educators need in order to keep buses, schools, and classrooms safe. I'm sorry, I'm Ginger Redlinger. I'm sorry. Is being withheld from them. The net impact of withholding information is an increased risk and less safe environments. I'm very proud of my school, my students, our law enforcement, and our social service agencies who have helped me understand the issues deeply enough to appreciate the impact of this legislation on everyone and how it will make Oregon schools safer for everyone. Senate Bill 1092 will make schools safer and more secure. The current laws let too much time pass before people are provided the information they need in order to keep schools safe. The current laws prevent people who have the information from sharing it with the people who are responsible for ensuring a safe environment for all. From August of 06 to April 07, I gathered information about these issues based on a few incidents that occurred in my school and in other Clackamas County schools. In April, when educators from around the state gathered at the Oregon Education Association Representative Assembly, I made a motion that we make changing the notification laws a legislative priority for this session. When 600 people from around the state agreed with me, it confirmed that it was indeed an issue of critical importance to all educators. During that representative assembly, I heard the following stories. A bus driver in Brookings suffered permanent damage to her elbow ligaments from a violent student. She had not been notified. She would have taken different steps had she known there was a risk of being attacked. Two teachers from Wilsonville shared their stories. A student who they later found out was convicted of sex crimes was grooming female students in class. After 3 weeks, one female student told the teacher that the other student was making her and the other females at the table feel uncomfortable. When the teacher asked the administrator about the student, she was told that no information could be shared, but thanks for the heads up. The next day, the student in question was removed from the school, and the teacher was not notified. She was told the information after trying to find out what happened to the student who disappeared. The teacher stated, had I been notified, I could have watched for generic behaviors, notified someone immediately, which protected the female students from the few weeks of grooming that they were exposed to, and maybe prevented the student from making another mistake. The second teacher told of a student who threw furniture, and while no one was hurt, the potential for serious injury remains. She does not understand why someone who is known to be that violent is allowed to stay in class. Property damage has occurred. Due to the student's violent outburst, she does not feel that she has a safe and secure environment, and neither do her students. The students selected to make up this classroom are students of families who do not interact with the school very often, so students do not go home and complain to someone who will do something about the situation. She feels as though she has to provide for the safety of her students. If she had more information to work with, she might be able to do things differently. At Southridge High School in Beaverton, a student who transferred into this teacher's class, within 10 minutes, a fight had broken out in the back of the room. The transfer student had a history of violence, and she had not been notified. She would have seated him differently in class had she been notified. At Canby High School, violent events occurred between students in different places of the building. Some of these events, reported by the gang task force officer, are related to intimidation and gang recruitment. Teachers told me, if we had been notified of the potential for violence, we could have been more proactive in monitoring places in the school to make sure our students were safe. In the last 2 years at my high school, here are some exemplary events. One student transferred into my classroom on the day we were using Bunsen burners. He gleamed, but then he told me he shouldn't do the lab. When I questioned him, he told me he had just been released and was on probation for arson. Had I been notified, I would have made accommodations so he could still engage in the learning activity, but I would not have placed him in a situation that compromised his confidentiality, endangered himself or other students. When I talked with the administrator later, he said he was not allowed to tell me due to the notification laws. A janitor in our building was subjected to verbal abuse and ongoing harassment by a student who had a history of violence. Had she known to watch for certain behaviors from the student, she would have sought help instead of trying to handle it on her own. Had someone not intervened, the student may have escalated the situation into a physical attack. Also this year, a student enrolling in our district commented that he moved here because a law enforcement agency in his California city said that if he left the state, he wouldn't be prosecuted. But if he stayed, he'd be looking at 20 years. When I asked an administrator in my building if this was the first time he had heard of this thing, he said no. This is not only an issue for schools, but of shifting law enforcement responsibilities and costs from one state to another. While completing research on these issues of notification, I learned that in Washington and California, students who are convicted of felonies and violent and sexual crimes that complete sentences and are released back to the community cannot attend regular schools. They are still offered a free and appropriate public education, but in alternative settings. I learned and had confirmed from my conversations with adults and students who came from these states that they come to Oregon because Oregon does not have this law. The differences in policies from state to state are contributing to an increase in high school-age students with criminal pasts entering the school. It can take 30 to 90 days for the information from one state to arrive, and so much can happen in that time frame, like the examples I shared from Canby, that is imperative to the safety of our schools that the laws be changed. In April, the education community asked me to come and share these incidents with you. So too have teachers from around Oregon who have shared their stories and encouraged me to work with our elected officials to increase the safety and security at schools. I witnessed and learned of many violent acts committed by students over my years. But in the past 4 years, the number has increased significantly. We need your help now. In closure, educators are trained to help students grow, to learn amazing things about themselves, the world around them, and the communities in which they live. We work with the students we are given. We take them all gladly. We access the information we have about them in order to provide an academically rich, environmentally safe, and secure environment. Educators remain committing to helping students, all students, receive a second chance should they need them. We desperately need information about what to look for from students who, due to past choices, pose a risk to the safety of schools. We know that keeping schools and classrooms safe is a priority for everyone. Making simple changes to the notification laws that are in Senate Bill 1092 will not diminish the opportunity for second chances. The changes may rather increase the likelihood that the transition will occur in a safer environment for everyone. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Mr. Bruno, do you want to testify? And then we'll all open it up to questions.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Alan Bruner, for the record. I teach at Colton High School, and I teach a number of subjects there, including science, math, social studies. And I would like to frame the discussion not around the written piece that you can easily read, but to talk about the fact that I am a personnel manager, as is every individual who works with students in both public and private venues. I manage the behaviors of about 150 students, and because of our school day, I manage them for an 8-hour period. We manage their learning, we manage their interactions, and as best we can, we manage their safety. In fact, as I'm likely to tell students on a daily basis, I am your parent. And as I was taught in my educator in the law class, in loco parentis is what every educator is bound to do to maintain a safe environment for all of our students. Every day I take roll, I see a roll sheet that has medical alerts on it. So I know a lot of information about my students. I know which ones are on medication. I know which ones are diabetic. And when I use that information, and I do, because I watch the students' behaviors, that gives me a chance to say very privately, you doing okay? The diabetic student that I have is very well managed, but because I have her in a number of different classes and a lot of performing venues, I have the ability to pull her aside and say, you doing okay? Blood sugar all right? I'm bound to maintain confidentiality because, one, my licensure depends on it, and TSBC has some very rigorous and stringent ethical guidelines that all certified personnel are bound by. I look at the bill that is before you in the same light. Because when I look at the safety issues that show up in my classroom in my day-to-day interactions with students, having information empowers me to be a better teacher, to look out for the benefit of all students. I'd like to give you a really quick illustration with a student I'll call JR. JR came to our school at the beginning of last year. He was in my Western Civ class. And like every student, I engaged JR and said, gosh, you know, interested in sports, interested in music, got some great performing groups. JR really wasn't interested in that type of activity. In fact, he pretty much stayed aloof and eventually gravitated towards that very small minority of students that exhibit behaviors that are usually associated with drug and alcohol abuse. About 2 months later into the school year, being the trained eyes, we had opportunity to confront JR on his behaviors. And in the course of him being talked with by our principal, his backpack was searched. And as you see in the written testimony, he had a special forces knife about that long. And again, because our school is small and we don't have metal detectors, nor do we have an on-site resource officer, the principal was left to deal with the fact that this young man had brought a weapon into school and had a bag of pills that were later identified as prescription medications. The young man was expelled according to our district policy, promptly went to the local Christian school about 5 miles away, and enrolled. And about a month later, wound up at the store next to our school. And as our students were over at lunch, one was propositioned, asking whether or not he would be interested in buying some drugs. Sitting next to JR was a 9mm pistol. And the student from our school was terrified, scared to death, ultimately went to the principal, who immediately called Clackamas County Sheriff's, and an arrest was made without incident. The parents brought the student to rural Oregon because they believed he needed a fresh start. And I do not doubt at all the parents' good intentions. I honor them for that. What was frustrating for us, though, is in our communication with the parents, They kept those issues private, and again, I understand that. But because of that privacy, the safety of the other students in my classroom had incredible potential to be compromised. What Senate Bill 1092 provides educators and educational support personnel the opportunity to do is just have that extra set of eyes, to act in a professional manner, to give counsel, and trust me, given the time we spend with Oregon students on a daily basis, we counsel perhaps more than we teach sometimes. But it gives us the opportunity in a very professional manner to keep an eye on students who may need extra support. So I would urge you to pass this bill, because I believe that in the greater good, the safety of Oregon students depends on it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, did you want to follow up or be here for questions?
Madam Chair, for your record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. I'd be pleased to back clean up and answer any technical questions or to also address the Dash 2s.
Okay. What I found interesting, I appreciate the testimony from both of you. Mr. Bruner, your testimony about knowing the student's medical condition on the roll sheet, that was really interesting to me, that you know that information.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's a private information. You can't share that. But it helped you be able to manage someone with diabetes, for instance. So really what you're asking is that instead of the medical alert, you'd have some other alert on your roll sheet, new student issues, or, you know, whatever the issues are. And I would think that someone would talk to you before the student went into your classroom. Is this sort of what you're hoping to get, some conversation from the superintendent, from your principal, before the child is placed in your classroom, that these are issues this child is coming with, let's develop a plan? I'm thinking, let's develop a plan. If you see these kinds of behaviors, what action plan do we have to help this child be successful in our school? Because it's not about marking a child with a big X on their back. It's about helping them be successful in your school. Isn't that true?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I could not have stated that better. That is absolutely correct. Because, as Ms. Redlinger said, public education is about working with whomever comes into our buildings, and it's working with them to give them the best possible public education we can, no matter what they come with.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? I really appreciate the time you took to come out and testify today, very much so. I think the last time you were here, we were congratulating you on being Teacher of the Year, but your reign has been turned over to someone else.
I bet it has.
And
actually, Chair Walker, I think it was most recently, he was with us in helping formulate the School Improvement Fund,
right.
A member of our committee.
That's right.
After being Teacher of the Year. So he's helped this body in numerous occasions.
While being Teacher of the Year.
Yes. Multitasker.
And Ms. Redlinger, my son is in graduate school to be a high school teacher right now.
Mm.
So I'm very, very much excited about it. And so is he.
Good.
All right, well, thank you. We've got a lot of folks to testify here, so we better get cracking, or we're never going to get done tonight. Let me see. I'd like to hear from some county youth services folks who are neutral on the bill, and then we'll go into the people who are opposed. Molly Rogers and Tim Lowen, is that correct?
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Yamhill County. And with me is Molly Rogers, Juvenile Department Director for Wasco County. We're here representing the Juvenile Department Director Association. We want to first start off saying we support community safety, public safety, safety of kids in schools. You want to make sure you hear that from us, because we do that. We do have some concerns with the bill as it was introduced. As we're reading through the amendments, the Dash 2 amendments, there are some concerns we have with that as well. Okay. We would, and as you're now receiving is testimony from us on this matter, really states in this testimony that we have another means right now of sharing information and of notice. And you'll see that attached to the back, the last sheet on your page. It's found in ORS 419A 015. And by that, right now, is required that on a monthly basis, the juvenile department sends to the school districts, and it's usually to the school superintendent of the district, the list of all youth in their jurisdiction that are on probation. There is a notice that goes out. It continues in that the school can request information, further information, which will be provided by the juvenile department on each of those youth. It allows for the passage of information on from the superintendent to any person they see as requiring or needing information within their school system. And it takes away any liability related to that conveyance of information. So one of the things I just want to make you and others aware of is we do have a means of sharing some information currently. It goes out not quite in the same way that this bill proposes, but there is information that gets to the schools on youth in our system. And what I've done in this document is to kind of share some of the differences in this, and I bulleted those down here in terms of what starts in this case.
And Senator Cruz has a question before you do that.
Just on what you currently have available, if you're in the juvenile department in Douglas County, you're going to release that information to the schools in Douglas County but not Lane County. And so if a child moves from Douglas County to Lane County, the information doesn't transfer, correct?
Yeah, it does transfer. It transfers in such a way as we have a statewide system in the juvenile justice. And so whenever we transfer a youth, we do it in one of two ways within the county. We either transfer the case in the jurisdiction or we do a courtesy supervision. Either way, between counties, we notify the counties that then comes upon their listing of youth in their jurisdiction that now goes out to schools, not just in their county, goes out to schools statewide, wherever the youth in their jurisdiction reside and attend school.
Okay, you're talking about if you transfer the student. What if the parents transfer the student? I'm reading what you have here, and I'm not sure. If he's no longer under your jurisdiction and the parents transfer the student, then how would a school in another county have access to that information?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, what happens in that situation is that the court has jurisdiction in a certain county. When it is transferred to another jurisdiction, say, for instance, the youth says, or the parents of the youth say, we're moving to another county. First, they have to get permission. If that move occurs, it starts out with the jurisdiction and the supervision of that probation remaining with the county that originated. What happens after that youth moves is that the county generally starts to carry on a conversation with the juvenile department in that county to say, would you consider doing a courtesy supervision of this youth? Once that youth once they accept that, that jurisdiction is then passed for supervision purposes, and it's placed into our database, and based upon how that's placed in the database, the new jurisdiction that's taking over supervision receives that youth into their jurisdiction. All the publications that come out on a monthly basis now contains the youth in that new school district. So the school district is still notified if the youth is on probation in the state of Oregon, or if it comes in as interstate compact through another state. They are also notified because we're doing essentially courtesy supervision for another state.
Thank you.
That's if a child is on probation. If a child is not and they've entered some plea deal and told to get out of Dodge to avoid prosecution, then you know nothing, correct?
This is true, and we wouldn't have any, if they're from out of state and that occurred from, we kind of refer to it as greyhound therapy, but if somebody has told them to move to our state or they've chosen to and nobody's been notified, we wouldn't know that information either.
Okay, and do we have interstate compacts with all states now?
We haven't signed the new agreement that's been going around for now several years at the federal level, but we still have agreements statewide or nationwide.
Okay, that's what I thought, because we've seen this in the Judiciary Committee before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Our primary concern is that we just want the venue to, we believe by meeting together with the interested parties on this, that we can probably come to some resolution, hopefully, on this
mm-hmm.
matter. Again, we certainly agree with the safety of youth and the safety of teachers, and we also have concerns for the youth that we supervise in probation and their privacy issues, their rights in terms of due process, and up until the time that the court takes jurisdiction on a matter, those kinds of issues come up for us as well. So we kind of play both sides on that in terms of protection.
Okay. Yeah, as the hearing neared its hearing time this afternoon, I started getting all kinds of phone calls and text messages. Where are you? We need to have a conversation with you because we have some concerns. So I got the sense that we just saw these amendments just before the hearing, and I'm getting the sense, though, that folks feel that they can reach resolution. It's just they need a little bit of time to get there, and that sounds to me like you're willing to participate in that.
I think most of the juvenile directors would be. We certainly want to, and we want to be included in the process with schools around monitoring the youth that we have there, working out safety plans, certainly supporting their educational success in terms of the kids we supervise, and making sure they're safe around the other students and staff in the schools.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Rogers, did you need to testify?
I would. Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee. I am Molly Rogers, and I am the Juvenile Director, Department of Youth Services in Wasco County, the Dalles. Hearing the testimony earlier, this seems like it has been bantered around since April of 2007. However, unfortunately, I just became aware of it about 3 days ago, and so I think some of the concerns that kind of came rapidly we've heard. We have, in our mission statement, like 35 other juvenile departments, public safety as one of our core components and missions of our juvenile department. And a big piece of that is open communication. I'd like to highlight just a couple of points about Senate Bill 1092 is really the intent behind it. I think we can reach some agreement on, but making sure that we don't create unintentional consequences by the bill, that we need to make sure that we take a look through and spend some time kind of vetting it through our different entities. Reviewing it, there's some contradiction and some clarification that needs to be done on who's to be notified. The criteria for notification seems very vague, and is one of my concerns is that the people who need to be notified are defined, and that there's some sort of criteria that not just everyone in a school gets to have information on youth. And then also the maintenance of records. Currently in the ORS, there is a process of transferring information. It comes back to the juvenile court counselor who needs to do that with the schools, like you spoke of. And in the new one, it moves that to the schools. And so at a time a young person might get their records expunged, tracking where all of those documents are could become a interesting process. And so making sure that those documents are clearly stated where they're at so they can be expunged. Was surprised slightly by this bill because I want to share with you a couple of stories in smaller jurisdictions in Central and Eastern Oregon. In Wasco County, we meet with our schools once a month. Every month, it's the first Thursday of every month at 7 o'clock in the morning. I will do it tomorrow morning. And we will run down a list of all new offenses in the past month with our law enforcement. And the important part about that particular meeting is the dialogue that goes back and forth. And we may say that this young Johnny got a minor in possession of alcohol as a random one to use, or a theft in the first degree, a felony. And there's dialogue back and forth so that the schools can get the information they need, not just on what's on a piece of paper, but they can ask the questions, and we have the right to give them that information.
Under this provision?
Under the records, the just general public okay. information for what young people, their right to know as far as the crime, the offense, kind of the details under what's public information. We can share that with them, but we can also share it with them some positive points about the young person if those are there too, or some extenuating circumstances, so that we really avoid what might be worst case scenario and intentional consequence, the labeling of young people very early in the process. So that is our example in Wasco County. Another county, which is Crook County, they have a meeting every Monday morning with their schools where they have open dialogue already going on. And so there's models out there that I think that we can build on. The other piece that is important is what a youth is initially charged with, the allegation, the alleged event, and what they are adjudicated on, sometimes are significantly different based on a review by the district attorney for the merits of the case, plea negotiations, those particular things that happen, those are different. And so how to balance what information needs to be given at what time, I think, is an important piece to take a look at. And then finally, I really just want to encourage that we want to encourage communication between schools and juvenile departments. And the issue that you, Senator Haas, bring up about interstate compact and how to work on notification when young people come into the state, I think those are all things we need to continue to work on to figure out how we can keep safe schools and safe communities and share in the needs of all. That's my testimony for you today.
Thank you, Ms. Rogers. Both of you added some very enlightening testimony. Senator Morse?
Thank you. A couple of questions here, if I may, Madam Chair. How long does it take to adjudicate a youth offender to the point of probation?
Chair Walker and Senator Morse, that varies across the state. And so that would take a little bit of time to do some research for you to be able to do that. We're just looking at that information in the Central and Eastern Oregon region very specifically on what time it takes for case processing. So I cannot give you a very global answer, but I can give you for Wasco County, it's less than 30 days if it's a non-contested trial. If it's a contested trial, it can take upwards of 6 months.
And that's my point, Madam Chair, is the time lag. If school teachers, counselors, administrators, I would think are your ally in this whole process, and the earlier they're notified of a child that has made a left turn when they should have stayed on the straight and narrow, irrespective of whether they are adjudicated through the process, seems to me it would be helpful for the youth. So that's just a reflection on possibly a shortfall of ORS 419. The other question would be, it appears that ORS 419 addresses public education only, and my question would be, how do you communicate, or do you communicate with, well, I assume the charter schools are a part of the district and they should be included, but what about private schools?
Chair Walker and Senator Morse, we notify all schools. And so our report comes from us through our JGIS information system. And for example, some treatment facilities have education systems in their treatment facility. Private schools, public schools, if we know, which we normally do, where a young person is enrolled in school, it goes to that school. Including, to be honest with you, we happen to border the great state of Washington. And some of our youngsters live in Washington and are on courtesy supervision only, and so we notify Washington schools.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Haas?
I just briefly, Madam Chair, want to say thank you for these are helpful notes here, and I take it that you're still on board if, we could keep working here. I share Senator Morris's thinking on if you wait for a conviction, say, in some of these cases, particularly California, that may be 6 months or longer down there, and by that time the kid is already in school. And so there's just it's just a timing issue. And I think the dash twos have already moved from what you might call the inception or the arrest of the crime into the secondary court proceedings. So, I mean, I think we're trying to get there, but if we wait too long, it almost makes the whole thing moot. The other thing, and it sounds like your models in Wasco County are working very well, but that's not to say they work well everywhere, and it certainly doesn't take care of the transfers from California who come in and nobody knows, you know, that they have a violent past. So, anyway, thank you.
And we often don't know that they come in from California.
They come from Montana.
Yeah, they don't have to tell us that they're coming.
All right, thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, we have about 12 minutes left for this hearing because I need to go into our final hearing at 10 after 5. So, and I have a whole lot of people left to sign up. So if you could just come up and state briefly what your objection is, because this is going to go into a little work group so that we can get it on the record. Let's hear that. So, yeah, Mark, Senator Hass.
Every 24 hours I'm going to do one.
That's exactly right. We're going to keep your record. So let's hear from the school, Chuck Bennett, Lori Satinspiel, Tricia Smith, and then I'll take OCDLA and Juvenile Rights Project after that. So please be brief. And if you have written testimony, we can read that.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We have really some minor process and definitions and sort of just minor nitpicking things inside this bill we'd like to work on in the work group and appreciate you setting that up, but generally are supportive of the thrust of the bill. Probably the only thing that I would add to it is we have seen this issue before, primarily at the bargaining table, and it still remains on the table in a number of districts. So perhaps we'll resolve this all here in the next couple of days and not have to bargain it any further. But and I know that's Lori would come up and join me on this if she could, but that's where we're headed on this, I hope. Thank you.
Okay.
Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. I truly appreciated the juvenile folks coming up and talking about some of our concerns with the bill. One that I just want to highlight is the potential to be in direct contact with the youth. And what does that mean? Do we over-notify? Do we under-notify? And then what's our liability? Thank you.
Okay. Oh. I heard that buzz. But given that I've just now given you two work groups, I will let you off the hook. Okay, thank you, Ms. Satinspiel. Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. We commend the sponsors of this bill for bringing the issue of violence against school staff to the legislature for discussion. We have some concerns with the wording of the bill. I have not had a chance to study the Dash 2 amendments. I've only had a chance to very briefly read them here in the committee. I appreciate very much, Madam Chair, your willingness to set us up in a work group where we can hopefully work through the issues in this bill and come to some meaningful solutions to the problems of violence against staff in the workplace, because it is a significant problem. Our concerns with the bill are that we're not sure this is the solution to that problem, or that this will perhaps have the unintended consequence of making the situation worse. So we want to make it better, not worse.
Okay. Well, that's what we hope to find out in a work group. You can air those concerns. I appreciate that very much. So thank you. And then let's hear pretty quickly from Mark McKenicky. I think I did that wrong. And Ann Christian.
I don't understand that one.
My mouth got ahead of me. And you, I hope, will be able to participate in the work group as well.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I understand that the work group is meeting tomorrow at 2 in the afternoon.
Oh.
And unfortunately, I am scheduled before Senate Judiciary on a property offense bill that I believe, will be a referral to the voters, so I believe I will have to be in that hearing at that time.
All right. Well, hopefully you can make sure that the parties know what your concerns are and get them addressed, and maybe somebody can go up in the hearing room and catch you at some point and say, are you okay with this?
That would be fine.
Okay. And so do you want to state your concerns?
Madam Chair, my partner has submitted written testimony, and OCDLA, which also has juvenile defense attorneys, we join in the written testimony, I would say that. And we definitely want safe and secure schools for our clients who are in the juvenile court system. And I guess I would just say that when we looked at the bill, we just, and having listened to some of the situations that are of concern, I found myself questioning whether or not the bill actually addressed the California issue, for example. So I'm certain that's one of the major issues that the work group will be addressing. And I'll be happy to participate over the weekend. Mark certainly can do a lot of the legwork for what I would do in that work group.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm a social worker at the Juvenile Rights Project. I've been at the JRP for 9 years. I've worked with at-risk youth for around 17 years now. I wanted to make a couple personal notes right off the bat. I could empathize and sympathize with a lot of the situations that the teachers described. I have worked in schools and in treatment programs, and I have been punched and kicked and had a chair thrown at me and been in a closed hallway when the police used their pepper spray on a client. And I know what it's like to be responsible for the safety of children in those kinds of programs. So I don't take those issues lightly at all, and I know from personal experience what a challenging job it is. Nonetheless, I also question that this proposed legislation will address many of the concerns that were raised by the school staff. Assessing risk of juvenile offenders, or in this case, offenders who are, or juveniles who are believed to have committed an offense, but that hasn't been established yet, has proven to be much more complicated than common sense would indicate. We are fortunate to have a recent study out of Multnomah County that was done to validate an objective scientific instrument that's used to assess risk of precisely the population that this bill concerns, youth when they first come into the juvenile system when charges are filed. And that validation study by an external researcher found that the severity of the what they call the instant offense, which is the information that this bill would require that the DAs or the juvenile departments pass on to the schools, is not only an unreliable indicator of that individual youth's risk, but it often indicates in the wrong direction. And the lesson from this study is that, one, there's no single indicator upon which we can rely to assess a student's risk or a youth's risk. And we must take a number of indicators that have been scientifically validated together in context. And in thinking about the analogy of the health needs of students, and it's important that teachers know, for example, if a student in their classroom is diabetic, I believe the analogy in this case is that we don't want someone to assume that a student has diabetes solely on the basis of a single symptom. And that's what we are presuming. That's what the basis of this bill is, that we can take one indicator and draw a lot of conclusions on that basis. For example, I'm thirsty, I have a dry mouth. I didn't suddenly come down with diabetes, even though that's one symptom of diabetes. I have a dry mouth because I'm talking in front of a legislative committee, and I'm kind of nervous, and this is a very important issue to me. So the context to understanding that bit of information is absolutely critical. And again, in listening to the testimony, it appears to me that much of the issues raised have to do with communication within school districts to relay information that they already possess. And I fully acknowledge that that's an issue. We have many of our clients in schools, and they're the staff, the assistants, teachers, counselors, school psychologists, principals often do not have the information that they need to most effectively serve students. But my perspective is that's more a resource issue within the schools. They have inadequate resources to better communicate and clear expectations about that. And also, there are a wide variety of practices within the schools about how files and records are kept. We request records for our clients on many occasions, and what we get and what we see in school records varies widely in terms of the completeness of the information, to say the least. So JRP is very willing to participate in this work group because, again, school safety is important, and we are talking about the safety of the children that we serve as well. However, I would like, I am a little skeptical that we can resolve all the complicated issues underlying this proposal in a brief work group process during a very short legislative session, and I would prefer to take the time to come up with strategies that we can all feel very comfortable with that really will accomplish the goals that I think we ultimately share. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McKechnie.
Thank you. Are you saying, though, that these crimes that are in the Dash 2 amendment, homicide, assault, attempt to cause physical harm, sexual assault of an animal or animal abuse, sex crimes, rape, are you saying that those history with those crimes are not an indicator, potentially, of future behavior, or something that a teacher or a principal should be aware of with respect to dealing with counseling issues or just separation from other different kinds of atmospheres?
Chair Walker, Senator Haas, thank you for allowing me to address that issue, because that is not my testimony. One, I wanted to reiterate that we are talking about allegations that have not been substantiated or corroborated. So that is something that we must keep in mind. I think the other issue, which is addressed in my testimony, is the juvenile code allows the courts pretty broad authority to detain youth for the crimes or the allegations that are listed in the Dash 2.
Well, I could just cut you off in just a second. The problem, though, with that is that many of those cases never go forward in California, say, because of an arrangement that's worked out before they're ever adjudicated, which is to say, all right, we won't prosecute you if you get out of town. So how would you address that when someone with this history moves up to Portland or Medford?
Chair Walker, Senator Haas, again, it's my belief that actually this legislation does not address that example, because if that youth was not adjudicated in the other state, the requirements of this bill would not be triggered. This bill cannot obligate a DA, for example, who may have initially filed those charges before they were dismissed, from notifying Oregon. This bill obligates what officials in Oregon do, and perhaps prospectively, if poor youth who move to other states from Oregon, they may get the notice, depending on how this information is handled. But I think that's part of our concern, is that some of the examples, I think, driving the need to have this some kind of protection actually would not be remedied by this legislation. And my editorial comment is, I think there's a class action lawsuit waiting to happen in California, because it's appalling to think that they would deny a student public, you know, a public education as a as leverage to and force them to leave the state, because you know, for all the problems we see, there are a myriad of educational alternatives in Oregon and that will serve the youth that we have here, whether they're in a local public school or in a youth correctional facility. They receive educational services.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your thank testimony. You. If anyone would like to, on the dais here, would like to join Senator Haas in the work group, I'm sure you would appreciate the extra help because, as Mr. McKechnie said, this is going to be very difficult to solve this in one work group. But will I... confident your skill, Senator Haas, and we have a lot of folks motivated to get this resolved. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1092.
Madam Chair, would you like to indicate to what date you would be carrying that bill over to?
We've got a lot on Tuesday. I don't know if I turn it over to Monday. I don't know that that gives everybody time to. Can we do it Monday, and then if it doesn't work, roll it into Tuesday?
Late.
And we can always go late. So let's move it to, let's roll it into Monday, and if we're not ready, we can roll it into Tuesday. But please try to get it ready so we can hear you Monday.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is for.
Okay, great. All right, I closed the public hearing, did I not? All right, we're going to open the informational hearing. Folks have been very, very patient. On programmatic resource fees, our bill from last session, Senate Bill 1029. As you all know, there's been resolution, and we have some folks here to talk about that resolution. I'm very pleased.
I'm not a committee. Okay, see if I can help. Yes.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance for the Oregon University System. And with me today are Monique Teal, who's the student body president at Southern Oregon University, and Tamara Henderson, who is the executive director of the Oregon Student Association. We are here to give you an update and on the resource fee issue. And I'd like to start by thanking you, Madam Chair, for bringing this matter into focus by the introduction of the bill you had last session. It really helped the board, I think, focus on the issue and work with the students, et cetera, and hopefully bring the matter to resolution. The process we used was beginning about a year ago, shortly after the bill was introduced. We formed a committee comprised of students, faculty, and administrators, of which the three of us were on that group. We met from February to October, during which time we briefed the board once at a midpoint in May. And at the conclusion of that process in November, we presented our preliminary findings. The board had some concerns, as did the presidents, and we went back and made slight modifications to our proposal. Brought that back in January, and the handouts that you have in front of you represent the board docket and policy changes that were approved by the Oregon State Board of Higher Education at their January 2008 meeting. You'll note in this that we are suggesting the elimination of resource fees effective no later than fall 2011. Why that date is important is there's a couple reasons. Number one, many of our institutions had already begun advertising their tuition and fees to prospective students for the fall of 2008, and we felt it would be too late to change that or be ingenuous of us to change that midstream. Secondly, as you recall, or I believe as you know, Western Oregon University introduced a tuition promise program in 2007-08, and we did not want to change those students' price tag or, you know, the tuition part of that, at least for that cohort, which will work its way through by the fall of 2011.
I was wondering how you were going to get around that issue, because I knew about that issue at Western.
Right, we're going to phase it in with each new cohort.
Okay.
Great. And then finally, there's some complexities with regard to graduate students in terms of, I've been meeting with the graduate deans at the larger universities and Western Oregon University to address, and it's partly related to the competitiveness. Our graduate tuition is, in many people's minds, already non-competitive, as well as a collective bargaining
and
issue.
Very there. High.
I'm very high, right.
And, my son can barely support himself. Right. Let me tell you that.
Okay. So anyway, that group is working, and I hope we'll deliver a report sometime before the end of this academic year. The other issue that I want to bring to your attention is, and we will begin to formulate instructions for campuses for preparing their 2008-09 tuition proposals this month. Those will go out, and those proposals will be reviewed and approved by the Board of Higher Education in their June 2008 meeting. We also have some process, I think, with the legislative body. There was a budget note that was attached to our 07-09 legislative budget that required us to keep tuition within the confines of median family income, I believe estimated at 3.4% per year. And this change will shift fees into tuition, potentially, and will have some effect on that. And working with Steve Bender, our legislative fiscal analyst, he recommended that we bring that back to an e-board in May, June, or July to just clarify what our intentions are, that we intend to comply with the spirit of that budget note, but that it may require, you know, you have to look at the total picture. The tuition may go up by more than 3.4%, but the fees go down, and in net, you know, it'll all work out. And, mm-hmm. and so that is our intention to come back sometime in the spring or early summer and deliver that report to an e-board and just, you know, inform the legislature what, you know, how we're moving forward with that. So at this time, I'd like to, you have in front of you what was approved, and we're saying no new resource fees for undergraduates effective this year and so on. And, you know, we're giving institutions an option to either go to differential tuition by program or to just roll these fees into base tuition for all students. And we're encouraging them to work with their student body leadership on each campus. Mm-hmm. I think you'll see some campuses do one thing and other campuses do another. Just, it really depends on the program mix that they have. Schools like Oregon State or Portland State to have an engineering program have very high resource fees, may choose a differential tuition. Other schools that have more of a liberal arts space like the University of Oregon may just roll them into base tuition. So the schools are currently formulating that, working with their administrative and student leadership, and I'd be speculating at this time to tell you exactly when and how they're going to do that. But they will do that, and they have agreed to phase them out by 2011. At this point, I'd like to turn to Monique, who will give you kind of a student's perspective of this process, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great, thank you. And I must state that Senator Metzger had an in-district meeting, and Senator Cruz has another committee, so that's why they have both left. So I apologize.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, evening now. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before today. My name is Monique Teal, and as Jay Kenton said, I'm the student body president at Southern Oregon University and a long-term member of the Resource Fees Committee and a member of the OSA Board of Directors, of course. The Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 students across the state of Oregon, universities, community colleges, as well as OHSU. And as a member of the fee committee, I'm here just to update you from the student's perspective. Students in Oregon have seen the rise of programmatic resource fees as state disinvestment in post-secondary education has left our campuses underfunded, as you know. Having maxed out tuition increases and left with inadequate budgets, campuses have been forced to nickel and dime students with the introduction of resource fees. Not only do these fees increase the cost of college, but they are not transparent for students. More importantly, students often do not know about these fees until they receive their tuition bills. This means that students and their families cannot plan financially for the fees and that they are not taking into consideration for financial aid packages, making it even more difficult for low and middle income students to pay for college, as your son has probably figured out. As you know, during the 2007 legislative session, students brought to light this serious concern as an issue through the introduction of Senate Bill 1029. 1029 would have frozen the introduction of new programmatic resource fees until a more transparent policy was created, with the end goal of ensuring the fees were included in financial aid packages. Senate Bill 1029 also required the Oregon University System to commission a committee of students, administrators, and faculty to resolve the issue of programmatic resource fees, to set aside and distribute fee remission money for low-income students in an effort to deter any students from their preferred major due to the cost, and to make information regarding programmatic resource fees available at the same time information about tuition and other fees is made available. Senator Walker championed this bill, but in the end decided that students would have more say in the final solution if it was addressed through an Oregon University System committee with student members rather than by legislators. As a member of this committee, I believe Senator Walker was correct. One of the things that happened consistently throughout the committee was a lot of discussion about the different sides of the table. We actually, more often than not, sat on different sides of the table, administrators on one end, students on the other end, Jay Kent smack dab in the middle.
Beat up by both.
Yeah.
Striped shirt. Yeah.
So more than once, he had to play the referee, as he said, which we're very grateful for. And I think one of the really great things about the committee is that everyone in there came in there with the intention of making sure that students came out ahead. And no matter what happened, the students were always the first priority. And so I really appreciated that. Due to the Oregon University System's willingness to find a reasonable solution to the problem created by programmatic resource fees, it is with great excitement that I'm able to testify before you today to say students, faculty, administrators have worked together to create a policy that satisfies student concerns. The differential tuition policy that was passed through the State Board of Higher Education on January 4th, 2008 will allow for increased transparency and the ability for the true cost of our education to be factored into financial aid packages. The committee worked to find a way to eventually eliminate all resource fees by rolling them into tuition, which is a revenue neutral solution, which would, of course, went into one of our guiding principles. I'm not actually going to go into them again since you have them in front of you, and as a student, I know that's just not fun to read it and hear it twice. But there is one thing that I would like to point out to you, is the student consultation regarding tuition fees and services should not only be continued but enhanced throughout the transition and beyond. The policy also requires the elimination of all resource fees by fall term of 2011, and some campuses, such as my own, Go Raiders, will be implementing these sooner. I'm particularly pleased to share with you the excellent system for fee remissions that were included in this policy. Administrators and students worked to ensure that the best system possible was created to ensure that low-income students were never deterred from choosing a major due to the additional cost of the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. What are you talking about? The current policy requires that an amount equal to 10% of differential tuition rates for undergraduate programs should be earmarked for financial aid funding targeted to low-income students majoring in the program assessing differential tuition rates. This truly accomplishes the goal of ensuring that assessing differential tuition rates does not become an impediment to degree choice. However, during the conversion, if campuses choose to create a system for fee remissions, this may cause an increase in the tuition over and above the amount of current resource fees. This creates a potential for some campuses to deviate from the legislative cap on tuition increases. Therefore, I urge the members of this committee to address these concerns in an effort to ensure that all students are able to benefit from the differential tuition policy for years to come without facing other potential cuts to valuable services on our campuses. While we are pleased with this policy to eliminate resource fees for undergraduate students by instituting differential tuition rates, unfortunately, the committee was unable to include graduate students in the current policy as, among other concerns, their collective bargaining contracts to consider. I would like to inform the committee that the work of the students as it relates to eliminatory resource fees is not over until all programmatic resource fees, including those for graduate students, have been eliminated. Again, I would like to remind the members of the committee that I have been at the Resource Fee Committee table since its inception and have participated in months of discussions regarding how to best implement the requirements set forth in Senate Bill 1029. The policy you see before you today is a great first step towards ending the problem of affordability in our public universities. While this policy isn't the end-all, be-all solution to access to college in Oregon, it is certainly a step in the right direction, and students are both happy and thankful to be part of this integral process. I would like to thank the members of this committee for supporting students in their efforts to increase transparency and access to public universities in Oregon. On behalf of all students, and in particular our board chair, Emily McLean, who really wanted to be here today but had to attend class, of course, I would like to especially thank Senator Vicky Walker for her tireless support and work on behalf of students on this issue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today and for all your support throughout this process.
Thank you, Ms. Teal. And I really want to thank my committee, too, because
It was my committee that said we agree with what we're trying to do here. We think we can get this taken care of in a non-legislative fashion. They agreed to support a letter that I wrote, and they've been dogging us just as much as I have. And I know Senator Moore, Senator Hass was not with us then, but I think I'm very proud of what's taken place here. And this is just an exciting day. I mean, what really, you pointed it out, Ms. Teal, what's really important is for us to really increase our investment in education for students. But we can't get there, you know, without some incremental change. This is a nice incremental change that I think just really makes it open and transparent about what students are paying for and doesn't freak them out when they get to school and they realize, oh my gosh, I got to come up with $400 more that I didn't have. Where am I going to get it? So that was really what we were looking for. I know when Mr. Kenton sent me the resolution, I sent it off to the New York Times, who had done a story on this, and he found it really interesting that we had solved the problem this way. So maybe other states will follow our suit. Ms. Henderson, do you have some comments yourself to make?
Chair Walker, I just wanted to be here to answer any questions that might come up. Thank you.
Okay. I think we did it. Senator Morris, did you want to make any comment? Okay. Senator Hass? Well, thank you. Thank you for waiting today. I hope you got some education in the legislative process while you were waiting.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Kenton, thank you. I know I beat up on you a little bit last session to get moving in this direction. You listened and you came back, and I appreciate it.
I appreciate your support, and my skin is getting thicker, though.
Yeah, you ought to check my back. It's very thick. All right, thank you. We've ended on time. We'll see you again in the future. We are closing the public hearing, or the informational hearing, on this Senate Bill 1029 from the 2007 session, and we are adjourning our committee.